podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
I'm Sam Keir, host of Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. For the past 12 months, I've been talking to T20 star David Visa, getting his take from behind the scenes at the IPL, the 100 and the rest of the world's biggest leagues.
That's the Donny Review system, Diogis. There's no ways in my mind that was up.
These guys don't know how to win at this stage.
He had his driver pick him up in his Bentley.
People start chanting your name. You kind of have to pinch yourself.
Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Sport Social.
Jones! Bowden!
He's got it! England have won the World Cup by the barest of margins!
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match!
Hello, welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket. That commentary line, the barest of margins, is it going to happen again? England are in the final for the second time in 3 years. A World Cup final beckons for England. A World Cup title beckons. They could be the first team ever to hold both the 50-over World Cup trophy and the 20-over World Cup trophy. Who would have guessed that, Simon Mann, even 3 days ago, that it was going to be England v Pakistan in the World T20 final in Melbourne on Sunday? A repeat, of course, of that great match 30 years ago at the same ground.
Well, England lost to Ireland early in the tournament. Pakistan lost to Zimbabwe, and they're both in the final. It's been an unpredictable, topsy-turvy T20 World Cup. And I don't think anybody would have thought that today's game would have turned out in the way it did. OK, England, yeah, could win the game, India starting as favourites. But to win by 10 wickets with four overs to spare is absolute thrashing and such a dominant display by England, and about as well, I think, as I've ever seen them bat in white ball cricket. I mean, they did a couple of performances sort of came to mind, the one against India at Edgbaston and the World Cup semi-final against Australia at Edgbaston, when they weren't under quite as much pressure. Australia hadn't scored that many in their innings, but England just romped to victory. They absolutely smashed it everywhere. And so, you know, so it was a bit sort of resonant of that. But against a good India side, to beat them like that. And if we're at a football match, I don't know how many football matches you've been to, but normally the away side, if they don't think there's much atmosphere in the ground, they sing, "Is this a library?" And the Adelaide Oval was a bit like a library for most of that England innings. England silenced them.
I thought you sang, "Who are you?" when you're starting to hammer the opposition. So it would have been tempting of England to England fans to be singing that in the second half of the Adelaide run chase. Well, there weren't many England fans there. It was probably about 90% India, and they were totally silenced. Yeah, an amazing performance by England. And actually, you know, one thing to think about really is how many players they've lost, because obviously Jason Roy dropped out of form, Bairstow injured. Also, they lost Rhys Topley before the first match in this tournament. Jofra Archer ruled out a while ago, and then losing Mark Wood and David Milan before this game. So it's an amazing injury list, but still they prevailed. And as you say, it was an absolute shellacking of India, who I think probably to everyone were one of the favourites of the tournament. And they looked pretty good leading into this match, and they were just absolutely obliterated. Amazing.
You can imagine the criticism that's going to be flying around in India. I mean, people take this, you know, they take it hard, don't they, when you lose a big match, especially in the manner that transpired in Adelaide today, with England so dominant in their batting effort. You can imagine the criticism would be surround India's approach. It was a very similar approach, actually, to New Zealand's yesterday. They were quite similar semi-finals, both of them. New Zealand getting a score on the board, thinking they could defend it. Pakistan, you know, romping to victory, not quite as emphatically as England, but still pretty clearly. And England doing the same to India today. So what about India's approach? Did England bowl well? Is it just that India are quite conservative in their mindset? I noticed actually that, here's something, just one of those, I don't know, coincidences, whatever, but perhaps it's not such a coincidence, that New Zealand in their power play yesterday scored 38. They were 38 for two. And India in their power play today were 38-1. There wasn't a real attempt, much of an attempt, to really put England under pressure. They just sort of sat in a bit and tried to build it for later. I thought England do it at the start, India do it at the end. Although, as it turned out, England did it throughout their innings.
Funnily enough, I got a lot of stick from Indian fans a few years ago for saying that I thought they were unambitious in power plays. You know, regardless of the class of somebody like Rohit Sharma, who's an undoubtedly world-class player, and actually KL Rahul is a damn good player as well. But I felt in world tournaments that they were a bit overcautious in power plays and left it all to the back end. And I think it's still the case that these players, Rohit Sharma, not really quite at the top of his game at the moment, so still felt like he was still trying to find his way. KL Rahul is quite an orthodox player who looks to, in T20, try and bat the whole innings and maybe get to 80 to 100 if he bats the whole innings, but he tends to accelerate later as well. And that seems to be the wrong way to go about it, given that a lot of these pitches have been, if not used, then at least they're not absolutely perfectly fresh. Therefore, the best time to bat will always be the first 5 or 6 overs where the ball slides onto the bat. Alex Hales said that about this match, Adelaide Oval. Best time to bat is the first 10 overs. Go for it then. Try and knock the top off the run chase. England did that absolutely supremely well. And I just feel India also, you know, they've invented T20 or reinvented T20 through the IPL and have obviously created lots of brilliant players through it, not the least of whom is Shirakumar Yadav, who is a tremendously successful and exciting player who does he's a daring player. He plays all sorts of unusual shots, but they haven't got many players like that, and England are absolutely littered with them.
What about Kohli's approach? He made another half century, didn't he? 50 or 40 balls, and then got out straight away after reaching his half century. I mean,
he was a bit unlucky, actually. I mean, he played well. He played really well. It's not easy when actually he was starved of the strike a fair bit in the middle of his innings. But I thought he played pretty well, and actually a brilliant catch by Adil Rashid got him out just when he was probably going to step on the gas a bit. So he was a little bit unlucky, but even Kohli is a very orthodox player. He's slightly easier to set a field to than the likes of Butler or some of the other England players, because they do play that full 360-degree game. I'm not trying to Kohli's record in T20 Nationals is incredible, isn't it? He's averaging 85. It's amazing. But India haven't won the tournament since 2007.
Yeah, there's another thing as well today. I mean, they've got a player like Rishabh Pant. Okay, he's only just sort of come in because of injury to Dinesh Kartik behind the stumps. They got Rishabh Pant, and there was barely any opportunity for him because of the way they played, because of that conservative approach. I know Pandya played really well at the end, but at one stage, they were 121-3 after 17 overs, and Pant was still waiting. And you feel when you've got a resource like that, that you do need to sort of take it on a bit more. It's so easy, isn't it, in hindsight. I mean, I have to say, at the halfway stage, with the sort of impetus given to them by Hardik Pandya, I thought 168 was a decent enough score in a semi-final. No, you can win with that. Scoreboard pressure, good side, crowd behind you.
Decent bowling attack.
Yeah, decent bowling attack. And you often find, in T20 cricket, the teams that get about 160, 170 actually creates a really good game of cricket. Often it's roughly the perfect score, isn't it, to have a real tight game. And when England started off, I thought this is going to be a tight game. My thought was probably India by just a handful of runs. I saw you tweet that as well. You said, I think, India by 6 runs. And that was sort of where I was as well. Because of the recent history, because of the pressure of a semi-final, because the ball was turning a bit, grabbing a bit. And it looked quite a tricky run chase. But, I mean, Hales and Butler just went for it from the start. I thought, actually, there's an interesting thing happened right at the start of the innings. Bhuvneshwar Kumar, you rightly pointed out on the podcast yesterday that he's got Butler quite a few times. But Butler changed his approach. He came down the pitch first ball. Kumar bought it a bit wide. It was given as a wide. I was a bit surprised at that. I thought that was a really tough call. It just seemed to unsettle him a bit. The keeper came up to the stumps. Kumar bowled a wide ball, Butler hit it for four. And so suddenly England were five off one ball. And it was just a little battle that Butler won. He hit another ball for four through extra cover. Kumar got a bit straighter. Butler clipped him through mid-wicket for four. So 13 off the first over. And suddenly England's confidence was lifted after, you know, a difficult last five or six overs when they were bowling.
Mm. So it was a good strategy from England. And you know, if we look back to the 2019 semi-final against Australia, you know, and the previous games which they had to win, the one against India and the one against New Zealand, they really readopted this sort of fearless approach. And this was something I suspected or suggested they might do coming into this game. But actually, it wasn't so much about fearlessness, it was more about clever strategy, wasn't it? And trying to just knock the opposition off balance a bit. And that worked really well with that first couple of overs. And so suddenly India had to change the bowling. I mean, Ashdeep Singh only bowled his one over at the start. Bhubaneswar carried on, but he just couldn't create any threat. And the thing is that with the T20, the white ball only swings really for one or two overs at the most. So in a way, Butler had negated the potential threat of Bhubaneswar Kumar in that first over by taking it for 13. And after that, he had nothing much to give. So then they had to start ringing the changes and bringing in spinners in the power play and things like that. And Hales did his bit as well, didn't he? I mean, he just thrashed a couple of big sixes to the longest boundaries at the Adelaide Oval, picked up on slightly short of a length ball and flayed it over the short square boundaries. And I think one thing that England did very well, you know, once the partnership was up and running, was they did really exploit those short square boundaries better than India did.
I thought another interesting thing happened inside the power play as well. So Akshar Patel came on to bowl the fourth over, and he tends to bowl it sort of hard into the pitch, doesn't he? He doesn't sort of give in the power play. You won't give it flight, and he's not a great big spin on the ball anyway. And what England did, they got right deep in their crease and lifted him over extra cover. So it's quite a difficult shot to play, and he was hit four first ball. So the point being that the spinners were never able to create any pressure. And actually, even when Ashwin came on, I texted you, I said, the position they're in now, Ashwin's a potential threat, he's going to get the ball to turn. And he did get one to really rip, didn't there? There was an appeal for a sort of a catch out towards the short leg area with the keeper running round that just came off the thigh pad. So I thought, just milk it, hit ones and twos, just tick Ashwin over, take him for, you know, like they do with Rashid Khan, say, in a or Ali or Rashid, taking him for about 24, something like that. Don't be too aggressive. And then, of course, Hales just whacked him into the stand, the deep backwards square leg. And so, that, you know, they played Ashwin really well. And the point being, the spinners, they never had anything to bowl with, really. They were always under pressure and having to sort of get wickets, really. And that's not a great position often for a spinner to be in a T20 match. You want pressure so the batters have to take them on. And if there's a bit of turn, it's, you know, it becomes really difficult. You miscue, catches in the ring, catches in the deep. And you have your joy, don't you?
They negated his opportunity for a mankad as well, didn't they? Did you see Butler?
Deep in his crease.
Well in his crease. Yeah. Deep in his crease when Ravi Ashwin was bowling. And this contrasts with England's approach against the Indian spinners, contrasts quite a bit with India's approach against particularly Rashid and also Liam Livingstone, who I thought they allowed them to bowl a bit too much. Mm. I thought Rashid bowled really well. Just when Rohit Sharma was thinking about setting himself to plant him a couple of times over deep wicket, he fired them in a bit quicker. And I think he read what Rohit Sharma was trying to do. I thought Kohli could have been a bit more adventurous. And then, of course, Rashid took the key wicket of Suryakumar Yadav as well. And good catch on the cover boundary. But just a little hint of turn there that just enabled him to get that wicket. And his control, Rashid's control. He bowled one full toss, which only went for a single. But other than that, his control was absolutely immaculate. And it's so difficult to do that in that pressure situation with the leg spin, you know, and these masters of spin as well at the other end and a pretty flat pitch. I thought his control was exemplary, but the Indians could have tried more, especially against Liam Livingstone, who's not an experienced spinner, doesn't have, as far as I know, doesn't have a good googly. So they could have been a bit more aggressive against him, but they just sort of sat in and they hit the odd boundary. But that's, I think, where their innings didn't really start to get any momentum. And it left too much for the last guys to do at the end.
Well, they were 62 for two after 10 overs. and England were 63 for no wicket after six after the power play. So that's when you look back, that's one of the areas.
Yeah, but it's one of the areas. But it's also keeping that if you have got to 63 after the power play six overs, it's then kicking on after that. Those overs 6 to 10 can when the field go back. And suddenly batsmen are sort of, well, it's not quite so easy to hit a boundary now. And they cut, sometimes they rein back. I think India do. They sort of rein back a bit. And that's when you almost need that extra power surge to continue the excellent work you've done in the power play, which England did very well.
Yeah, England did. They just kept on going. Just on that, those four overs after India's power play. So they went to the power play at 38 for one. They scored 24 off the next four overs. And that underlines your point, with the field back, they just knocking it around. So they went at six and over. And then the real surge came after the 10 over mark, when they were 62 for two, and then they got over 100 runs in the last 10. And that's where the game seemed to change a bit. And, we saw Hardik Pandya having an evening out, didn't he? I mean, he's such a devastating hitter. When it's his night, there was one ball where he hit Jordan for six, and then off him a short ball, and the next ball he pitched it up. It was probably just a bit too leg side, and Pandya flicked it into the crowd at deep square leg, and Jordan was sort of walking back, almost smiling to himself and shaking his head as if to say, wow, what am I supposed to do? I bowl it short, it goes for six. I pitch it up, it goes for six. Not easy when Pandya was in that sort of mood. He's an extravagant hitter, and he sort of hits it in odd areas, doesn't he? And hits it in odd ways.
Well, he hit one from Sam Curran, which I reckon was a perfect wide Yorker, would have landed pretty much on the popping crease, wide of the off stump, and he steered it immaculately, just wide of short point and wide of the deep point, just managed to get in the gap between them for four. I don't think it was possible for Sam Curran to bowl a better ball than that, given what he was aiming to do. Yeah. He couldn't have done it any better, and still Pandya got it for a boundary. So a fantastic player, and just not able to have the impact with the ball that I thought he might have with that bit of extra pace. And I suppose India, they didn't have someone who could crank it up to 90.
Jasprit Bumrah was not there, was he, Gaz?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we haven't mentioned that they were missing him, and obviously he's their key cutting edge. But maybe on the day, it wouldn't have made any difference. I mean, England just played so well with the bat that you felt that even if they had, four West Indies quicks at them, they would still have gone at a rapid rate.
Yeah. Some days, it happens, doesn't it? You have a glorious day out, and that was what England had today. I mean, I thought their World Cup semi-final win against Australia back in 2019 in the 50-over World Cup was just about pound for pound their best ever a one-day international performance. You think big game, Australia, World Cup on the line, and they played an almost perfect game that day. They were absolutely superb. They won the match well inside the distance, really confidently, no trouble at all. And there was sort of an element of that today as well, almost a perfect T20 game. They did get a bit knocked off their perch in the last few overs of their bowling effort when they started to go around the park. Jordan in the 17th over. Where are we? Jordan, the 18th over, went for 15. Curran, the next over, went for 20. And then Jordan just dragged it back a bit in the last over, went for 12, and they picked up a couple of wickets as well just to hold things back. But there were, there were times when India were scoring every over. They were scoring at least 10 off the over in the back end. And you thought, 168. But as it turned out, no trouble at all. I mean, the way they played, could they have chased? They might have chased over 200. I know it's a different issue with scoreboard pressure and all that sort of thing. But, just a remarkable opening batting performance from Butler and Hales.
Yeah, and they're also, just one other thing about England, fielding held up well again. Some slightly tricky catches were taken with ease. Sam Curran, I thought, caught a good one to get rid of Rohit Sharma just when he was looking dangerous, running in from deep mid-wicket. Rashid, an excellent catch at backward point or a short third man to the slice that Kohli tried to create a wide ball for four. And that was a really sharp catch. And also the catch on the boundary to get rid of Yadav by Phil Salt coming into the game. He must have been a bit nervous with such a big game like that. And he looked calm under the high ball. So those three catches were held. And of course, India, with that one chance to get rid of Butler, they fumbled it and knocked it over the line as well, which I thought kind of almost, I know that was by then the game was lost, but still it sort of rather symbolised their error-strewn fielding effort.
Well, in our podcast yesterday, Yoz, we talked about the makeup of England's team and who they should play. And in the end, they went for Salt and Jordan. I mean, who would have thought that Phil Salt wouldn't have even had a bat and the rest of the batting lineup? And that was due to the brilliance of Butler and Hales at the top. So they now move on to Melbourne, the final. I presume the crowd is still going to be, you know, touching 90,000. There'll be a few people who've got tickets to that game who are probably desperately trying to get rid of them, perhaps off to India supporters to Pakistan supporters. I mean, Pakistan have got a big passionate support as well. There'll be a little bit of support for England. I presume some Australians will come along as well. It'd be interesting to see what the turnout will be on Sunday, actually, you know, whether the tickets have changed hands, whether it's going to be 90,000 or whether it'll be, you know, down 40, 50,000, something like that, with no India in the final.
Do you know, it's funny because I was at the World Cup final in 1992 in Melbourne, which, of course, is, as I said at the start, a repeat of this match coming up, England-Pakistan. And I think the final was on a Wednesday, bizarrely, and I flew
was
back.
It? No, I don't think.
I think
it was.
I think it was. I think it was on a Wednesday. We can check as we're chatting. But I flew back to England either on the Thursday or the Friday, and I remember being on a Thai Airways flight and just chatting to people. There was I think I was in business class, bizarrely, which is quite unusual. And there was a bar. And I was sort of standing at the bar, sort of chatting in the days when flights on the upper deck had a bar for the guests, and I was chatting with these two guys who were obviously English, and they said they were both from Bristol, and they'd gone to the World Cup final having found out that England were in it. They'd literally bought two tickets from Bristol via London to Melbourne to watch the final. They told their wives they'd gone up to London for a meeting, for a conference, and gone all the way to Melbourne and watched the final, watched England lose, and then flown back. It was an amazing occasion, actually, that final. Obviously, because of the new Southern Stand, which is now the Shane Warne Stand, had only just been built. And it was the first time it was full. And it was like I was up at the top of the stand because I thought I'd sort of experience that sensation of the biggest cricket stand in the world, right at the top. And actually, I remember watching Derek Pringle bowling, you know, one of the early overs, and the players were like specks, tiny little specks in the distance, and I couldn't see the ball at all. So I didn't spend much time at the top of the stand, but it was full, you know. And someone told me, I think that stand itself holds about 30,000 or something. So if it is full on Sunday, it's going to be incredible, isn't it? With the noise and the buzz of it. I mean, wow, it would have been even more incredible if it had been India v Pakistan. And I guess the organisers are slightly disappointed that England have sneaked through or hammered their way through. But I'm sure it'll still be a tremendous event.
I've just put what day of the week was the 25th of March 1992 into a search engine, and bingo, the answer has come up. It was a Wednesday. Why on earth are they holding the final on a Wednesday? So you're getting a bit older, Yoz, but your memory still holds. So well done on that one. So was there in 1992? Was there a lot of Pakistan support? Was it like the sort of support we experience now?
I don't think so. No, it wasn't. I mean, I don't recall a big Pakistani contingent, because I think in a way, I don't think to sort of make a very general point, I don't think the Indian diaspora, which is sort of including Pakistan in a way, had quite swelled across the world as it has now. And, you know, we're talking 30 years ago, and I think there would be less a Pakistani community in Melbourne at that time. And also, they hadn't played particularly well in the tournament, had they? They sort of got into the final almost by accident, with that last ditch run chase in Auckland, getting them through the semi-final, having been a no-hopers during the group stages. So they wouldn't have had sort of travelling fans either. And I just think that there just wasn't that kind of cosmopolitan essence to Melbourne quite as much as there is now. You know, I think it's the second most populous Greek city in the world, isn't it? After Athens as well. But obviously, it's a real polyglot Melbourne now, and I'm sure there's lots of people who were born in Pakistan or have Pakistani heritage there to take up the option of a few Indian tickets, which will now be on the market. It will probably feel like a more of a home game for Pakistan.
Yeah. That 1992 final, always sort of harking back to it, it was 50 overs, wasn't it? It wasn't 20 overs. It's 30 years ago, but it's an England-Pakistan final. And England, they lost it by 22 runs. Some tremendous bowling, I remember, from Wasim Akram, but I mean, Derek Pringle, not whenever we see Derek, but if you get him onto the subject, I think he feels that umpire Buckner should have raised his finger a couple of times.
He's got that I was robbed sort of... Yeah. Mantle, hasn't he? When you ever mention the World Cup final, yeah. And I remember seeing that at the time. And actually, I've analysed one of those balls in slow motion a few times. I mean, obviously, the cameras in 1992 weren't as good. The replays weren't as sharp. We didn't have HD and things like that. But I've watched that replay of Tajawid Miandad a number of times, and it was absolutely plum LBW that for some reason Steve Buckner didn't give. It's a shame for Pring. It will go to it'll haunt him to his grave, won't it? But it was a stunning performance by Pakistan, and in particular Wasim Akram. Those two wickets in two balls, when Lamb and Fairbrother were going really well, looking on course for England to chase the score of 240 or 249, I think, wasn't it? And they were playing really well, and then Wasim Akram came back on, bowling round the wicket, and he bowled that ball to Alan Lamb, totally unplayable, angled in from round the wicket and then straightening with late reverse swing, bowled him off stump, absolutely fantastic delivery, and then produced a ball that swung the other way to Chris Lewis, next delivery, and he dragged it on. And suddenly the game was up for England. Fairbrother tried his best, but England were just sort of fell behind the rate and couldn't quite kind of get there, didn't have the back end power in a way that England teams do now. And the Pakistanis just kind of swarmed all over them in the end and really deserved the victory.
Yeah, it was a very good performance from Pakistan in the field. I mean, England were 69 for four, chasing 250 to win. Pakistan made 249. They recovered to 141 for four in the 35th. And then that Lewis double from Wasim Akram, 141 for six. I mean, England did have a bit in the tail in those days. I mean, they had Lewis at seven,
Daffy.
Dermot Reeve at eight, Derek Pringle at nine, Phil De Freitas at 10, and Richard Illingworth at 11.
Well, that's
It's not the worst.
No, it isn't.
Lower order,
no,
is it?
No, that's a fair point, actually. I mean, Richard Illingworth was a blocker, but Daffy, De Freitas, was actually a dangerous hitter. Yeah. So, in a way, I should take that back. Mm. They did have some power at the bottom, but they just weren't able to utilise it because the Pakistani bowling was so good.
Yeah, well, incredible, remarkable triumph from Pakistan in 1992. What about Sunday's final then? I mean, these two teams, it's fair to say, know each other pretty well. They've just come off the back of, well, a seven-match series, and they played a warm-up match against each other as well in Australia. So they've actually met eight times recently. That's an incredible stat in itself. England have come out on top in those games, but then recently India have come out on top against England. So, I mean, it looks like a 50-50 game, do you think? Or do you think England, because of their performance today, are slight favourites? But then, you think back to what they did to Australia in the World Cup semi-final of 2019, and then the final was an incredibly sort of... Well, what happened in the final?
I don't know.
So someone should make a documentary
well, sure.
about it.
Well, yes, and thank you for that little kind of lead-up, because there was a lovely scene in our documentary, The Greatest Game, which was from the England media liaison man, Danny Rubin's phone. He filmed a little conversation, a little address by Trevor Bayliss, the coach, to the team, just after they had celebrated that brilliant win in the semi-final against Australia, and they were all patting each other on the back and cheering and fist pumping and all that, and Trevor Bayliss stopped them dead, and this is what he said.
I put my Australian cap on now and tell you why Australia thinks England don't win finals. You win a semi-final and you think you've won it. We haven't won anything yet. The next game's the most important one, so let's make sure we're 100% for that.
And it was a lovely little intervention, which the players all sort of looked at each other and thought, yeah, Actually, he's got a point there. And he just brought them all back down to earth. And that's what they need to do again, isn't it? That there will be a slight temptation to be cheering from the rooftops after that demolition of India. But I think now they've all been round the houses long enough to know that they've got to come down to earth very quickly and think very rationally about how they're going to beat Pakistan.
Yeah, well, that's Matthew Mott's job to deliver that sort of speech, isn't it? Another Australian coach in that England dressing room who's in the background as England got through to another World Cup final. Pakistan, very strong bowling attack, quite reliant on their top order of Babar Azam and Mohammad Rizwan, as we saw in their semi-final victory. Indeed, as we saw quite a lot in that England series, when they generally, when the top two did well, Pakistan did well. They had that stunning partnership when they chased close on 200. It might have been 200 to beat England in one of those matches in that seven-match series. It's a great matchup, isn't it? I think an England-Pakistan final, and it's very difficult to predict which way it's going to go, because I've been pretty hopeless in my tipping so far. I thought India would win today. I thought South Africa and Australia, or South Africa dark horses, Australia would win the tournament. I'm definitely going for a Pakistan victory on Sunday. I think it's absolutely clear that they're going to win and reproduce what they managed 30 years ago. But it's going to be a really gripping occasion. We had a great final in 2019. Let's hope for something similar when the two teams meet on Sunday.
So is that your theory, your strategy, your philosophy there? Is if you say what is going to happen, it definitely won't happen. I it's funny, but you know, it takes me back to years with my parents, which are both of them sadly passed away now, but they used to sit at the table, and my mother worked out that if she said something that she didn't want, my father would politely argue with it and say the other thing, and that which she would actually get in the end, what she wanted. So that was a strategy which I think you're employing today. I'm going to say England are going to win, and I've been saying it all along without all the time having a lot of conviction, but I just feel they've got so many options, especially with the bat and actually with the ball. I mean, you know, it's interesting the way they just kind of bring Stokes on to open the bowling, for instance. I'm not sure I wouldn't do that, because I think opening the bowling, that first over is so important to set the tone, to use a horrible cliche. But it's a one over when the ball does actually swing, and Stokes does swing it. But is he the best person to really exploit that? I think I would be giving the first over to either Sam Curran or Chris Wokes to really make sure they utilise that swing as much as possible and hopefully get an early wicket. Stokes, I know Stokes sometimes does get an early wicket, but it tends to feel like it's a little bit lucky. Whereas if you use your best bowlers in that first over, but, you know, credit to England, you know, they do turn up with some unexpected people. They bowl Rashid in the power play in this match, and he did delivered. They change it around a little bit in the middle of the innings. Liam Livingstone sometimes comes on. Obviously, Moeen Ali is available if they're a left-handed batsman at the crease, though not many in the Pakistan side. Shaan Masood's probably the only one, I'm thinking. So unlikely to use left-handers. But looking at the Pakistani batting, it's not that good after the openers. You know, the openers are supreme, Babar Azam and Mohammad Rizwan. But after that, not entirely convinced. Shaan Masood has done a manful job at number three, but he doesn't set the world alight. He kind of ticks keeps the scoreboard ticking over. They've got one or two players who can smack it, Iftikhar being one, Asif being another.
Harris.
But, yeah, actually, Harris have got, no, I've forgotten him. And you know, he's come into the side late, so he's dangerous. He's their sort of their X factor in a way. He could come off, I suppose, but I sort of feel, you know, they haven't got a lot after sort of number six, really. Whereas obviously England have got that back end of Livingstone, Moeen Ali, Chris Wokes, Sam Curran that is very dangerous. And that's where I think possibly England will have an advantage.
Yeah, well, the point about it is, on their day, both sides clearly are good enough to win, aren't they? And take down the other side, one-off match. I mean, they sort of had a final at the end of that series when it was level, and in Pakistan, and England won the final game. So they've sort of got a bit of experience of that, winning it, you know, winning it against the crowd as well. So that experience will stand them in good stead. But it's a World Cup final. It's a completely different type of experience, different conditions, massive crowd in. And, yeah, who knows who's going to win? I mean, you can. It's such a. I think it's a 50-50 call, really.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of this tournament, really, that you can throw up unexpected results. We've had one today. We had one the other day. So two teams that didn't really look likely to get to the final. Well, certainly Pakistan didn't anyway.
Well, I think England after Ireland, after the Ireland defeat, yeah, as well.
Yeah,
England.
Yeah, you know, they've got there, and it's now anyone's game, and I'm really looking forward to it. Sunday morning from the MCG with the shorter straight boundaries and longer square boundaries. So England will be hoping Mark Wood can regain his fitness, because I think he'll be important using the shorter ball to try and take wickets in the middle of the innings to those longer square boundaries.
Yeah, and both sides have had experience of playing at the MCG in this World Cup already. So, yeah, they'll be familiar with the conditions, but will they be familiar with the pressure of the day? And it's all to look forward to. A really mouth-watering occasion on Sunday. And we'll be back on Sunday to look back at the game and to work out which of us was right, whether it's you, Yoz, going for England, or me going for Pakistan.
And if you want to get in the mood for the final, don't forget our documentary, The Greatest Game, is on Sky Documentaries on Catch Up whenever you want to watch it. And keep a tissue handy, because you might shed a tear, but you'll also need a bottle of champagne to celebrate an amazing win. Perhaps England can match it on Sunday. Let's hope so.
Podcast Network.